Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I would like to welcome you to the Johnson Triama Graduate School of Public Policy Public Lecture, aptly named, and we did this really before we knew what was going to happen today, after the political storm assessing the effects of the 2016 U.S. election. Daniel's already said that, in fact, we should remove after because I expect there's more storm to come. My name is Murray Fulton, and I am a professor in the Johnson Triama Graduate School of Public Policy. I will be the moderator for today's event. As many of you know, the Johnson Triama Graduate School is, in fact, one school with two campuses, and I would like to very much extend a warm welcome to our colleagues and guests at the University of Regina, and you can see them up there on the screen for those of you here. For those of you in Regina, welcome, and I hope you can get a sense of what's happening here on this end. The Johnson Triama Graduate School of Public Policy is a provincial policy school for advanced study and research in public policy and administration. The school is the product of a unique partnership between the University of Regina and the University of Saskatchewan, and is based on the spirit of cooperation and collaboration that defines Saskatchewan. I would like to acknowledge that today's event is taking place on Treaty 4 and Treaty 6 land, and the traditional homeland of the Métis. I think we are all in shock this morning over what happened last night in the U.S. election. The purpose of today's event is to shed some light on what happened and what the consequences might be. How did Donald Trump, someone that is uniquely unqualified to serve as U.S. president, as some commentators have said, actually win? Will he be a reckless president, or will he make America great again? To answer these questions and more, we have assembled a panel that is exceptionally well qualified to give us some insights. Let me quickly introduce our panelists for this morning. In alphabetical order, they are. Here in Saskatoon, Daniel Ballon. Danielle holds the Canada Research Chair in Public Policy at the Johnson Triama Graduate School. A specialist in fiscal and social policy, he has published 4 books and numerous journal articles on U.S. politics and public policy. In Regina, Cheryl Camille is an assistant professor at the JSGS. Prior to coming to Canada, she worked for many years as a campaign professional and policymaker in the United States. She played lead roles on presidential and congressional campaigns in the 1990s, and she served as technical director at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Here in Saskatoon, John Courtney is Professor Emeritus Political Studies Department, where he taught for 39 of his 51 years at the U of S. Since retiring from active teaching in 2004, Professor Courtney has continued his research and publications as Senior Policy Fellow Emeritus at the Policy School here. And finally, in Regina, Dale Eisler is a Senior Policy Fellow at Johnson Triama Graduate School. From 2007 to 2011, he was Consul General for Canada in the U.S. based in Denver, Colorado. He spent 16 years in the federal government after many years as a journalist in Saskatchewan. So that's our panel this morning. And as I said, I think they are uniquely qualified to give us some insights this morning. The format is going to be as follows. Each of our panelists will speak for 10 minutes. I will flash something to the people, at least here, so that they get a sense of that 10 minutes. And they will speak in the following order and on the following subjects. John Courtney will start and will speak about the presidential race. Daniel Ballon will then speak about congressional and state races. Cheryl Camille will speak about the policy implications for the United States. And Dale Eisler will speak about the implications for Canada and Saskatchewan. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to John. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be able to speak to you today. I wish it were otherwise, but I'm afraid that's the way it is. And as someone said, the sun came up again this morning, and presumably, all going well, it will set tonight. But we're all in a state of shock. I think that's fair enough. Now, there are many, many aspects to the presidential race that I think we could examine today, and certainly in the Q&A we can have a look at these. Let me just single out four. The first would be the role of the press and the media. The second would be the role that Bernie Sanders played, which I happen to believe is actually quite critical to the outcome of this election. The third is the beginning of what I would call identity politics. And perhaps beginning is not quite true, because it's been with us for a while, but I think we really saw it last night, big time. And the fourth would be the role of the email, such as it was. Was it as critical as some commentators make it out to be or not? First of all, the role of the media. I don't think there's any question about it. Donald Trump had, for the first 9-10 months of this competition, going way back a year and a half into the early stages of the primaries, he had a free ride. He was good copy, he was controversial, it was cheap advertising for him, and every single media outlet picked him up, whether it was electronic or print journalism. He was the center and the focus. There were, you'll recall, something like 13 candidates running at that time. And several of them, quite legitimately in my view, complained to the media saying, he's only one of 13. But their retort was, you're not good copy. You're not making controversial statements. That's why we like him on the front page of the newspaper and the lead item on the television news. So gradually, as the opponents fell off, Kasich and Bush, Christie, the whole list, you can go on and on and on, the media began to wake up. And I think it was the Washington Post that first started this in any serious way, followed then quickly by the New York Times, began to look at his statements, and they put out fact checkers, and then all the media got into fact checking. But my submission would be that it was too late. The damage had already been done. He was the focus of attention, which, by the way, he desperately sought. That's another question. He was the focus of attention, and the storyline became him as the likely and then eventual nominee of the Republican Party. Secondly, the role of Bernie Sanders. At the same time that Trump was taking this position, controversial as it was, or these positions, I should say, in the Republican Party, Bernie Sanders was to the left of the conventional Democratic positions, and very much in line with what we would call in Canada the Democratic Socialist position, calling for universal health care. Scrapping Obamacare, by the way, remember that, scrapping Obamacare and replacing it with a universal health system, publicly funded, free college tuition for children, and on for college kids, and on it went. I mean, his agenda was, by any standard in the United States, out of the main field. But he attracted a lot of attention, and one of the reasons he did was he challenged Hillary on her ethics, accepting big money from Wall Street, never really disclosed how much it was, but in the several hundred thousand dollars for speaking engagements time after time after time. And the result was he kind of prepared the groundwork for what later became the Trump attacks on Hillary Clinton. Scrapping Obamacare, he didn't bother replacing it with a government system, but scrapping Obamacare, and more important, on her trustworthiness and her ethics. So that was important. The third point I want to mention, just in passing, is I think we saw, played out in spades last night, and that was what we now call identity politics. And there are really four elements to identity politics that became apparent to me last night. Forget about voter turnout, whether it was Hispanics were low, Afro-American, black Americans were low. Forget about that for a moment. We saw increasingly the coverage last night, no matter which channel you turn to, the emergence of the exit polling data on gender and a gender gap, race and a race gap, class slash income, definitely that, and education. So quite educated women, especially the younger ones, tended to vote for Hillary Clinton, and on it went. I mean, we're all familiar with these categories. But I think it's important to recognize that what we've done as observers looking at this is classify people very neatly into categories. And sometimes that does a disservice. Sometimes it's not fair to the different categories of people. But I would submit that nonetheless, that's the way we're beginning to think about American politics. And there's one other group, in addition to these four in which there were gaps. The other group would be those who were disaffected with politics, with Washington. You remember, Trump will clean out Washington. He'll get rid of all the dead wood. We'll have a new America. These are wonderful slogans. They make you think of one of the great characters of American political history, Al Smith, back in the 1920s, running for the Democratic nomination. He was going to clean up politics. And there's a truth to that, because people are, in the United States, disaffected with, they feel no obligation to any particular allegiance to their congresspeople, to their senators. They feel they have been negatively impacted by these. And Trump was going to save them. So there's a kind of messianic message there, if you get what the point that I'm making. And finally, the last point, very controversial, and we frankly yet don't know the answer to this. What role, if any, did the disclosure of the emails, and especially the role of the FBI, have to play in this? It's debatable. Certainly, Hillary Clinton created her own problem. I don't think anyone would deny that. She asked for it, and she got it, and that was fair game in politics. She should not have been using a private server for important classified and presumably important data that was being transmitted electronically. Okay, fair enough. Then the FBI suspended the investigation in what I would now call stage one, and said, you know, we can't find anything to criminally to follow up on this and prosecute her criminally. So they suspended their operation. But when they resumed it, about what, 3 weeks ago now, big controversy. The Democrats were leading not only in the polls, but also in the Senate races. And it could be that the Senate, which is now, Daniel will speak to that, controlled by the Republicans, it could be that that tipped the balance back in favor of the Republicans from the Democrats. Who knows? We've got to make sure that we determine that in post-election analysis. But I would argue that I think Comey, it's sort of hard to know how he saw this. He may very well have done the honorable right thing in saying they were resuming their investigation by looking at the 650,000 emails that were on Hillary Clinton's aides and her estranged husband's email account. Let's say he had not said anything, and then it was discovered after the election that he was sitting on those communications. If they had exonerated Hillary, no problem. But had they been critical of her, and had she won the election, and had they led the FBI to determine that there is, in fact, something there that could be prosecuted. So it was a tough call, and Trump played that every which way. I mean, that's par for the course. But I think it's important to recognize that. Now, Trump is coming into office owing no debts to anyone in the Republican Party. Certainly Paul Ryan, John McCain, the Bushes, on and on. The list goes on. men and women in the party who said, we have no use for him. We will not endorse him. He happens to be the candidate who's been nominated by the party, but we're campaigning on our own. So you had this conflict within the Republican Party, which meant he didn't have any of the stars going up on the stage with him. Not that he would like to share the stage with a star, I don't know. But he didn't have, you know, LeBron James, for example. He didn't have Bruce Springsteen. And on, the list goes on, and Beyonce, and so on. And in a way, I think that was a problem that Hillary Clinton created for herself, because it reinforced, at least in my mind, the fact that she was establishment. She's got all these friends and contacts she can pull in to campaign with her, whereas Trump was the lone wolf, and he played that brilliantly. He doesn't owe anything to the Republican establishment, nothing. He may owe, ironically, more to Vladimir Putin for the email leaks than he does to the Republican establishment. Okay, I'll let it go with that.
So good morning. First thing I want to say before I talk about checks and balances in Congress and what's happening at the state level, I want to say that what happened yesterday shows, I think, a tremendous failure of the polling and forecasting industry in the United States. Even Nate Silver got it wrong, although Nate Silver, to be fair, said that just before the election that Clinton had a 70% chance of winning. You have media outlets and even academics at prestigious universities like Princeton who thought that Clinton had 95 or even 99% chance of winning, okay? And that's what's based on national but also state polls and also historical data. So that's important to start from this perspective. There's a lot of work to do for people who do electoral sociology, for pollsters and for political scientists in the years to come to analyze what really happened last night and what happened before the election and why so many people were wrong, including people with PhDs in political science and who have worked on these issues for many years. The second thing I want to say is that what happened last night is really unique in the history of the United States, the political history of the United States, because it's what we witnessed yesterday is only for the fourth time in history, as far as I know, but one of the few times in history where someone who had never held an elected position somewhere at the state level, the federal level, was elected to the White House. So here we have an outsider, but someone even who had no experience in government, because the three other presidents I can recall who actually never held elected office before entering the White House were former generals and high-ranked militaries. The last one, of course, was Dwight Eisenhower, was elected in 1952 and re-elected 4 years later. And then you go back to the mid-19th century, of course, you have Zachary Taylor and Ulysses Grant. You know, major military figures. So people who had experience in policy and politics within government, but not as an elected official, but within the army, which is part of government in the broad sense of the term. So what happened last night is really dramatic. And we have someone here who has no government experience whatsoever who will enter the White House. And I don't remember any case of someone who is so ill-prepared for governing the most powerful country in the world. Now, very cheerful talks this morning. Now let's talk about checks and balances and how it might be related to Canada, because of course yesterday we had, of course, elections in the United States. You had many referendums on a number of issues like marijuana and so forth. We are not talking much about this now because I think there are other issues that captivate our attention, obviously. But we had also, of course, the House of Representatives was up for grabs, so all the representatives were running for re-election. They do so every 2 years. One-third of the senators were, one-third of the seats were up for election as well. And we had also elections at the sub-state level, so in the American states. And that's very important to keep that in mind. right now, the way we look at the situation in the Senate and the House in the aftermath of this election, Republicans are in control of both the Senate and the House. Their majority in the House is strong. Their majority in the Senate is small. So although they are controlled by Republicans, they only have a very slight majority in the Senate. And Democrats could still put forward filibusters, for example, because Republicans don't have the supermajority of 60 that's necessary to break a filibuster. That's a bit technical, but that's quite important within the U.S. political system. But still, there is really no checks and balances in terms of having another party in power, either in the House or the Senate, facing an Republican president-elect, so Donald Trump. So that's a major issue. If we talk about the Supreme Court, of course, Donald Trump will be able to appoint, or should be able to appoint, a very, very conservative judge to the Supreme Court. He put forward a list of a number of people he thought would be qualified, and these are all very, very conservative people. So talk about checks and balances, the Supreme Court should tip back into really conservative territory with this ninth judge being appointed. So that's what we could foresee. At the state level, the situation in terms of checks and balances is not much better. Of course, it's not at the federal level, but it's still important. Most governors are Republicans. And yesterday, the situation didn't change. Republicans control most of the legislatures at the state level. So where will the counterpowers emerge? Well, of course, you have the media, civil society. After the election of Barack Obama in 2008, and Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate, if you remember at the time, although they had a very, again, a small majority in the Senate, the Tea Party emerged. Now, I'm not saying the Tea Party is a model for oppositional politics outside formal institutions, but certainly you could imagine something on the left that could emerge as a grassroots movement to actually oppose some of the policies put forward, not just by Trump, but by a unified Republican government, okay, or unified, actually, Republican government in the Keynesian sense of the term, if you want. And that's a possibility. Now, if you look at the Senate, because Republicans have a small majority there, you have some so-called moderate Republicans who could actually, in a way, play a role to oppose Trump, President Trump, on some key issues like immigration and trade. I'm thinking here about people like Lindsey Graham and John McCain, I'm thinking here about John McCain, for example, and people like them who are adopt a more moderate stance in the Senate and could forge an alliance with some Democrats. Democratic senators, but this is not what we could call a very strong counterpower. So this is quite stunning that we end up here with Democrats really kicked out of the White House, but also in a very, very weak position in Congress and at the state level. So this is an issue, you know, back in 1969, it's an issue for Canada and for all countries who deal with the United States, which is the entire world, because this is such a powerful country. This is our greatest economic partner. In 1969, Pierre-Éliott Trudeau said that living next to the United States was like sleeping with an elephant. As equipped, no matter how friendly or temperate the beast, one is affected by every twist and grunt. Well, the beast grunted really loud last night, and right now, Canada will have to sleep between several elephants, not just President Trump, but also, of course, a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and a majority of Republican governors. So this is a difficult situation, of course, for a prime minister who ideologically is much closer to Hillary Clinton than Trudeau. And I think these are things that certainly Dale Eisler will want to talk about later. Now, one thing I want to say in the end about a Trump presidency and what could happen in the legislative arena is that there is a lot of unknowns, because the policy, the so-called policy ideas that Trump put forward are extremely vague. We'll build the wall, we'll repeal Obamacare, but then we'll maybe create something better in place of it, but maybe not, we don't know. So it really, really vague policy ideas, quote unquote, and Trump himself is not really historically a Republican. Some years back, people thought he was a Democrat. Is he really that conservative or not? Also, who will he appoint in cabinet? That's very important too. That will be very important to know who he appoints, to see whether he will just reward his friends with helping help him win this campaign against the odds. And that will, of course, tilt the cabinet really on the right in a big way. Or he will appoint people who are really qualified for these positions and try to move a bit closer to the center. We don't know, because Trump has never held public office before. He's an unknown quantity in terms of public policy. And so what the United States did yesterday, what American citizens did, is that they opened the Pandora box, and we don't really know what will come out of it. But certainly it's a lot of work for political scientists, policy analysts, and people who are interested in U.S. politics and society to analyze what happened yesterday, but follow very closely what will happen within the next few months, as Trump will hopefully put forward clearer ideas about what he actually wants to do regarding immigration, regarding trade. Because right now, just saying that things will be better or great is really not substantive enough to make much sense from a policy standpoint. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Danielle and John, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I'm going to talk, as Murray had said earlier, about the policy implications of this victory. I think that President-elect Trump will find that the last year and a half of campaigning across the United States back and forth was a lot easier than than governing will be, especially in the first 100 days of the administration. He has already pledged a contract with the American voter for the first 100 days to make America great again, which you can find on his website. And it is amazingly ambitious, even if it's a little vague and not detailed. I'll just share some of the items with you and talk about some of the other policy issues that might come up that he'll have to address early on in the administration. As both speakers have said, he's pledged to repeal Obamacare. That is a piece of legislation that is 1,000 pages long with thousands of provisions that took 4 years to implement, that has provided insurance to 20 million Americans and provided better benefits to them, and has also made winners of many in the healthcare industry, including the insurance plans. So it will not be easy to repeal. And that's just one of many health policy issues pending in front of Congress. He has pledged, and this is in no particular order, to replace the nominee for the Supreme Court and to push that through. He has pledged to introduce a constitutional amendment to impose term limits on Congress, which is quite a big deal. He will, in the first 100 days, pass legislation according to his plan to build the wall, to end illegal immigration, and to deport what he thinks are 2 million criminal illegal immigrants. He has pledged to renegotiate NAFTA, as many of us know, especially here in Canada, and if not, to withdraw from that agreement. He'll have to work with Congress on that. He's also pledged to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He will redirect funding that currently goes to climate change projects to building energy infrastructure, and along with that will give approval to the Keystone Pipeline, which President Obama canceled. And I can't forget this big one. He has pledged within these first 100 days to introduce and pass legislation to cut taxes for certain segments of the American population. He says it's the Middle Class Tax Relief Act, but it looks like from different analyses that have been done that it will benefit corporate taxpayers the most, dropping the rate from, I believe it's 35% to 15% for taxes. And there's other issues, including, and I haven't talked about foreign policy, obviously. He has pledged to build up the American armed forces quite precipitously. And while he hasn't included this in the 100 days, some other issues pending are to revoke the Common Core education standards that have been implemented in most states across the United States now. And at some point, he'll have to address the solvency of the Social Security program, which is the U.S. equivalent of the Canada pension plan, which is projected to go insolvent in less than 20 years. And so, of course, is a big concern to Americans because most of Americans rely on Social Security payments to support themselves in retirement. So American presidents have three tools to implement policies. One is executive orders, where they take unilateral action. It's somewhat unlikely that President-elect Trump will use executive authority because he campaigned with the promise, which is also in this contract, that he will revoke all 250-plus executive orders that President Obama issued in his 8 years in office. And so he would be hypocritical to use that authority. That doesn't mean he won't use it. We have seen him flip on issues. But he will probably be called out for using it if he does. There's regulatory authority, where he relies on the cabinet departments and other federal agencies to regulate policy. That will be difficult to utilize, especially in the first 100 days, because, as Daniel alluded to, first he needs to identify and nominate individuals to lead those cabinet departments and agencies. In the United States, all of the leadership at the top of the federal government has to be nominated by the president and confirmed by the Senate. There are 12 to 1,400 positions where the nominations need to go to the Senate, and the Senate needs to hold hearings and confirm. And not much work gets done in these federal departments until the new leadership is confirmed by the Senate and installed. I worked in the federal government when the transition went from the Clinton administration to the George W. Bush administration, and I can tell you that not even the smallest policy decisions were made between November and July. We sat there, we kept sending paperwork up to the highest levels of the department, and it sat there literally until July. I didn't get any decisions on any of that until starting in July. There's also the issue of the federal workforce is feeling very put upon and very demoralized, to say the least. Another provision in this contract is that he would freeze hiring for all federal civilian employees except for public health and defense and intelligence. The federal workforce really bore the brunt of much of the responsibility for much of the recovery out of the Great Recession. They went without pay raises for several years, and at one point they didn't even get paychecks for over a month. And that has led to a lot of leaving. And then there's also the issue of the aging of the federal workforce and retirement. So you have a very green, demoralized staff there. And the third tool is legislation. Daniel talked about the prospects for legislation. The legislation that he is proposing to push through in the first 100 days is pretty complex, major legislation. These aren't small items. And so in addition to the issues that Danielle raised, I'll just point out a couple others. Yes, he will have the Republican Party in control of both chambers of Congress, but he has shown that he can't always get along with Paul Ryan, who might be the Speaker of the House in the new Congress. And he even had to endure, from his perspective, the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's criticisms of his behavior on the campaign trail. And we have seen that when he's slighted, he holds grudges and has trouble working with people he feels has slighted him. So I don't see a guarantee that the even though the he's not beholden to anyone in the Republican Party, including Republican legislators, I don't see a guarantee that they'll work well with him to move legislation. There is also the issue that the U.S. Congress has been historically dysfunctional over the last decade or so. It has not passed the bills that fund the federal government on time in over a decade. In fact, when the lame duck Congress convenes in a couple weeks, the number one item it needs to work on is funding the federal government past December. Right now, the federal government is operating on what's basically contingency funding that was approved just to get the country through the election, which means that the cabinet departments can't plan. And it's likely that there will be lots of debate about what to do as far as continuing the funding through the inauguration, which takes place on January 20th. Congress has also passed fewer bills in recent years than it used to traditionally pass because of the dysfunction. Many of us know that the House Speaker Paul Ryan landed in that position when the Republican Party basically revolted against his predecessor, so they don't fall in line very well. A couple other issues that might make legislating difficult. Bernie Sanders, who John Courtney talked about, has started an organization called Our Revolution, where he is trying to take some of the energy that he generated and that was in many ways spontaneously generated in the campaign on the liberal or left side and direct it toward changing policies. We'll see how effective he is with that. And while the governors are mostly Republican, they tend to act less ideologically and very practically when it comes to responding to federal legislation. So they'll think very much about whether something's in their interest. So when it comes to repealing Obamacare, the governors, I think, will start to think about, well, what does that mean for monies flowing to our state, and line up according to how it will impact their states as opposed to whether or not it's the administration's bill and supported by the Republicans in Congress. At least that's my take on that. And finally, one other reason that legislating might be difficult is that whereas in the case of most new administrations moving to Washington, there's a honeymoon where there's a lot of positive energy and support of the new administration. So the new administration basically gets a pass for the first few months or so. I'm not convinced there will be that positive energy around the Trump administration. I lived in Washington when President Obama came in for his first term, and I can't describe to you what it was like to be in that city with Americans descending upon en masse to celebrate our first African-American president. I had seven people staying in my house that I had never even met before. They basically showed up at my door and said, "We're here for the inauguration, can we stay?" And that was everyone's experience. There was all this great energy. But the energy that brought President-elect Trump into, or will bring him into office, is a more negative energy. It's very angry. And so I'm not convinced we'll see that kind of positive force. And I'm not even sure if the inauguration will be a very big one. He had a very small victory party compared to most nominees last night. And he has seemed to be very uncomfortable interacting with the public. So I'll just say a couple more things to wrap up. I talked about his plans for the first 100 days. There's 72 days between now and then. There's a very complex transition that has to take place. And I think it will be difficult for him for a few reasons. The chair of his transition team is New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who's dealing with a bit of a scandal resulting from Bridgegate. While he hasn't been implicated directly yet, I think that taints him somewhat. And as Danielle alluded to, the team of trusted advisors to the president-elect are very small, and they're not Washington people. In fact, some of the names that have been put forward or suggested as his cabinet picks are non establishment non-Washington types like Ben Carson, the doctor for the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Carl Icahn, who was the inspiration for the Gordon Gekko character in the Wall Street movie, has been suggested as being his pick for Secretary of Treasury. And like it or not, there is a way that Washington works. Relationships are everything. I lived there for 20-some years. I can vouch for this, and anyone you talk to who's lived in Washington will vouch for this. Relationships are essential, and there's a way of relating in that town that's very important. You have to maintain those relationships, and the way people talk there is not the way a New Yorker talks. I'm originally from New York State, and I can tell you to talk like a blunt New Yorker doesn't work in that town at all. I also have some doubts whether he will ever be fully committed to life in Washington. I question how soon his wife and his young son will move there. And part of me thinks that he'd much rather live in the Trump Hotel at 1100 Pennsylvania Avenue than in the White House at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, just five blocks away. I think if he could get away with it, I bet he would live in the Trump Hotel. And in fact, I was thinking about what Inauguration Day might look like. It's traditional for the viewing stand to be in front of the White House. I suspect it's going to be in front of the Trump Hotel. And that's what we'll be seeing on TV. So those are my thoughts about the policy environment.
Thanks, Cheryl and Danielle and John. I agree with everything that's been said to this point. There's not a single comment that I would take exception with. And I would also agree that we are all in shock. I think most people are in shock. That seems to be true. But I think we have to be careful. We're in shock, we're surprised, but we can't miss the point here. And I want to pick up on something that Cheryl said that, for me, explains a bit what happened. So I'll get into sort of the effects on Canada from my perspective. But before I do that, I want to sort of try to understand what's happened in the United States. And Murray mentioned at the outset that I lived in the United States. I was there in 2008. I was actually living in Denver when the Democratic National Convention was on that selected Obama as the presidential nominee. And it was an incredible week. In Denver, there's something called the National Democratic Institute, which is almost an appendage of the Democratic Party. It's supposedly nonpartisan. It was started by Madeleine Albright. And it holds events, it does all sorts of things to advance democracy around the world. But with the national conventions, presidential nomination conventions in the U.S., it holds parallel kind of events where they'll bring people from all over the world, come in, they have panel discussions and whatnot. And, of course, this was Obama's nomination, so the entire world was focused on what was going on there. And people from all over the world came to take part. And I remember sitting in, it was an August evening, the culmination of the convention in Mile High Stadium in Denver with 90,000 other people for Obama's acceptance speech. And the atmosphere was incredibly electric. And people from all over America were there and from around the world. And I remember sitting, and I was next to a couple from Georgia, African-American couple that had come to witness this, right? This nomination of an African-American to be president. And there was this sense of, you know, this is a watershed moment in the United States, kind of a defining moment. And at the NDI, the National Democratic Institute events, too, people talked about sort of a post-racial United States and whatnot. So there was incredible, incredible optimism, as you talked about at the inauguration. People so hopeful. And I dug out a quote that Obama gave that night in his speech, just one point. He said, "We meet at a defining moment when our nation is at war, our economy in turmoil, and the American promise has been threatened once more." And I think we tend to forget what was going on in the United States at that time in terms of the depth of the recession that was going on and the trauma that Americans were experiencing. And Obama's election, I think, exposed really deep political and economic and social fault lines in the United States for all kinds of reasons, partly because of the pain people are going through in the United States at the time, in terms of the recession, losing their jobs, losing their homes, far worse than what was happening in Canada. This was a crisis of the financial sector. People were losing their homes. This did not happen in Canada. So people there were really in desperate situations. Incomes, you know, were not keeping pace. People felt that there was no upward mobility. They were very, very traumatized, you know, the disruption from globalization and technology. All these things were having a tremendous effect. So all gets manifest then in the rise of the Tea Party. And I would argue racism, again, reemerged in the United States, in part because of Obama's election. And, you know, this sense of economic disenfranchisement, it being economically left out. And we saw the takeover of the Republican Party essentially by the right, the alt-right, which leads us to where we ended up in this current presidential election with the rise of Bernie Sanders on the left, where again people feeling alienated, left out, and on the right, people feeling the same way. But I do think sort of the beginnings of that was in 2008 with what was happening in the United States. So I think that we need to be careful not to rationalize this. And there are certainly failures of the media, no question about that. But we need to kind of understand what took place. And there's a quote from a piece that was in the Atlantic Monthly recently, and this is relating to the press. And the writer, Selena Zito, said, the press, speaking about Trump, said, the press takes him literally, but not seriously. His supporters take him seriously, but not literally. And I think that's very true, right? I mean, if you take him literally, how could you take him seriously, right? But he spoke about issues that mattered to people, and so I think we have to understand the depth of alienation that exists in the United States and the fault lines that exist in that country. So, having said all that, what does this mean for Canada? Well, the Canada-U.S. relationship is very much, a cornerstone of it obviously is leader to leader, so president to prime minister. I have a hard time imagining how Justin Trudeau is going to develop any kind of a relationship with Donald Trump. He obviously had a very good relation and has a very good relationship with Obama. In fact, Obama was sort of handing the torch to Trudeau when he was down there a number of months ago in terms of being sort of a progressive leader on the world stage. With Donald Trump as president, that just, I think, disintegrates. NAFTA is obviously at risk, at peril. And, of course, there are critics of NAFTA, but I think unequivocally it's been a positive economic and social benefit in total for North America. Not to say people haven't been dislocated and there hasn't been, you know, some negative effects. That's inevitable. But in a macro sense, it's been very good. And if Trump actually ends NAFTA or renegotiates it in a serious way, this will have major economic consequences for Canada. Our economies are so integrated. The supply chains between our two countries depend on free trade and on NAFTA. And if we see significant change there is going to be negative economic impacts for Canada. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which Canada is supportive of, that's not going to happen anymore, with a Trump presidency. The other major sort of policy issue that the Canadian government has established with the United States in recent years is something called Beyond the Border, which is a perimeter approach to economic and human security. So the argument Canada has made in recent years, going back to the Harper government and before, was that, yes, we need security, secure borders, but we need efficient borders, too, because of our trade relationships. So we convinced the United States that a perimeter approach to this would work well. So we don't have to make the border with the United States more difficult. We can just have common sort of perimeter laws that, in terms of people coming into our countries, that we're both comfortable with. And this was, I think, a significant step forward. I think with Trump's focus on security, the whole border issue is going to get opened up again. And that could, again, it could have very negative effects for Canada. I think we can forget about an ongoing climate change debate in this country. I cannot imagine, it appears Trump will not go forward on climate change legislation. And if the U.S. doesn't, I don't know what that means for the Paris Accord, but without the United States as part of this, and Obama was clearly very, very supportive of it, I don't know how Canada goes forward alone on the current strategy if the United States is completely offside. I mean, I think this is not sort of a rational economic choice for Canada because you need a partner on this with the United States as best you can. So I think that is likely going to be off the rails. Softwood lumber, which has been a long time irritant between Canada and the United States, that we've struggled with for many years. I think the protectionist impulses in a Trump administration and in Congress is likely going to be very harmful for our softwood lumber industry, which will have very negative effects for British Columbia. And the other thing that Trump has talked about NATO, and obviously Canada is a member of NATO and very supportive of NATO, and he talks about free riders, that people don't pay their fair share, don't pay their dues, whatever, for NATO. And actually, you can make that argument about Canada. We're supposed to be allotting 2% of our GDP to defense and to NATO, and that's by 2020 is the objective, and we're not there. So I think we could see some pressure from the sort of defense side of things in the United States for us to step up our financial support of NATO. I think the only other thing I would say is, and now this is treading into sort of the political effects, not the policy effects, because you can't help but think, could this possibly happen in Canada? Could we see this Trump phenomena occur here? I think the short answer is yes, but I wouldn't say it's highly likely, but I think it could happen here. Because this populist wave in the United States will put wind in the sails of similar sort of sentiments here in Canada, right? They'll take there's this notion, this anti-establishment kind of view, and I think you could argue that our current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is very much symbolizes kind of the elites and establishment, you know, former Prime Minister's son and whatnot. If we get into a world here in Canada where there is on various issues growing sort of opposition to the government, I could see it kind of coalescing around the sort of the similar sort of populism, sort of anti-elites, and you know what do they really know? I mean, in Canada we're not as polarized as the United States because we have a multi-party system, which really helps. So I think it's less likely, but I would never rule it out. And I think the last thing I would say, and this goes back to my days when I used to be a journalist, I always, and applying it now to the election last night, there are always two things that I sort of took away from elections that really mattered. One was, is there a mood for a change? And if there's a mood for a change, usually you can't stop it. And secondly, who has the momentum in the last week of the campaign? And I was, you know, troubled in the last week by that. Because clearly there was a mood for change in the United States. The only question was Trump too extreme for that change? But he also appeared to have momentum, too. And so when those two factors come together, I think often it's almost impossible to stop. So that's what I think.
Any final comments from Regina, from our Regina panelists?
Well, I would just say on that point, I agree entirely with Daniel. I think there's going to be a shift in terms of, we're going to see the political resistance emerge more outside of Congress, and it's going to be in these social movements like Occupy Wall Street, Bernie Sanders and his movement, right? What form is that going to take? I don't think those people are going to go away. And I think that given the reality that Trump has a pretty strong mandate here, and he controls Congress, and that I would assume resistance in Congress is not going to be great, that it then will, the shift will be to civil society, which in a way is a good thing, I think, because it engages people in the democratic process far beyond just their voting. One last thing I'd just quickly say, there is an argument, and there was a professor over in Oxford who wrote something I read a week or two ago, who argued that the best outcome for democracy in the United States in this election was for Trump to win. Because he said if Trump lost, there would be so much anger and sort of sense of disenfranchisement people being disenfranchised, right? The people that supported Trump, because clearly there was a big movement behind him. They would believe all this rhetoric that the system is rigged, right? And and there would be such resentment and anger that it would lead to a very dark place. And he said that sort of counterintuitively that a Trump victory, and this was before the election, would ultimately be the best thing for the democratic society of the United States, because it would be seen as an actual democratic response to people's sentiments, whether you agree with them or not.
Mm-hmm. On that note, I think all of our panelists have given us many things to think about, as have you, our wonderful audience, both here in Saskatoon and in Regina. So let me just say once again thank you to our panel, John Courtney, Daniel Vallon, Cheryl Camillo, and Dale Eisler, for your insights and for taking the time this morning. And thank you, audience members, for joining us here, for asking questions, for listening, and for participating. This is, what you're doing is exactly what we've just ended up, I think this is actually fitting that we ended our conversation talking about the way that society and people need to get involved. And this is part of this, and I thank you very, very much for coming out. So
thanks,
have a great day.
Great.